I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Joining me now is Andrew Weaver, a leading authority on climate change. He is the author of a new book, Keeping Our Cool, Canada in a Warming World. It is, according to David Suzuki, a gripping narrative and a call to action. It is an accessible and comprehensive look at global warming with a view on Canada and climate change here. Andrew Weaver is a professor at the University of Victoria, where he is also the Canada Research Chair in Climate Modeling and Analysis in the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences. He is a lead author on the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the organization that received with Al Gore the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. Weaver is also a member of the Order of British Columbia. Keeping Our Cool is published by Viking and retails for $34. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Andrew Weaver. Good morning, Professor Weaver.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I was talking to someone not so long ago about global warming, and they asked me, do you believe that it exists? I was sort of taken aback. I'm in my mid-20s, and I guess my generation has taken it to be a given. Is it?
Well, I mean, like you, would have been taken aback. I get that question all the time. It's as if it's a religion. I believe in this, or I believe in that. I mean, it's about science, and it's not a question of belief. It's a question of fact. And yes, global warming is happening, and yes, humans are the overwhelming cause of it. And so, you know, let's move on. I mean, do you believe that the world is flat? I mean, this is the same kind of question. Do you believe that smoking causes cancer? I mean, these are the same kind of questions. At some point, you know, science has answered questions, and we have to move on.
So where does the skepticism come from?
Well, it's very, first of all, people don't want to believe that they've had have an effect. I mean, people want to do good. They don't want to believe that they're doing something bad. And global warming, of course, is a consequence of all of our activities and the combustion of fossil fuels. So there's an inherent desire not to be part of a problem. And if you are, you want to fix it. So, but secondly, there's a very well-oiled or well-greased campaign out there to try to sow the seeds of confusion within the public. The idea being is if the public believes there's somehow this raging scientific debate about global warming, then there's not going to be pressure on politicians to take action to deal with it. And what would those actions do? Well, they would have to be actions that would actually limit emissions. And there are special interests involved whose emissions would be limited. So, of course, they are very involved in trying to ensure that such actions are not taken. So there's, you know, this is part of the, and this is, I spent a lot of time in the book going over some of what is happening out there.
And is the argument, has the debate over whether climate change is man-made, is that finished?
It's been finished for more than two decades. Well, not quite. Let's see. In 1995, the first studies started to appear that were able to unequivocally prove that, well, prove is a strong word in science, to show that the warming that we have observed is detectable above a background of natural variability and is attributable to combustion of fossil fuels. So that those first studies appeared in 1995. It's not that we couldn't say that global warming was occurring and that humans were the cause. The difference is that there's a lot of variability in the climate system. We know a lot about that. So in order to say that we're detecting a signal, it has to be, the signal of warming has to arise above anything that could occur from any mechanism of natural variability. And that's happened since the mid-1990s.
I'm curious, as a climate researcher, can you predict the weather?
Well, that's climate. Weather and climate are different things. So let me give you, I'm not a weather forecaster. You know, I can read a few weather maps here and there, and I can, you know, do a little bit of this and that with weather forecasting, but I'm not very good. But that's, I am a climate person, and climate is different from weather. For a number of ways I can explain that. But first of all, let me give you a climate prediction, a really good one. I predict that the winter will be colder than the summer. Yeah, and you're laughing at me and saying, yeah, right. But that's a climate prediction. It's based on the fact of laws of radiation, the fact that we know how the Earth's tilt and we know how it goes around the sun. And you know what? It's the same, very similar physics, radiation physics, that is associated with global warming. So this is the difference, right? I'm not telling you that the weather in December the 31st will be cloudy and rain in Vancouver or snowy in Regina. I'm telling you about the climate. And so the reason why, of course, is that weather is what's happening here and now at a particular place. So if you're making a weather prediction, you're predicting the conditions of the atmosphere in some, you know, rain, wind, some very short distance in the future. With climate, you're predicting the likelihood of occurrence of a particular weather event. And we can actually show theoretically that it's impossible to predict weather beyond about 2 weeks. So you know, we're not predicting weather beyond about 2 weeks. We're predicting climate. The statistics of weather, the likelihood of occurrence of a weather event, or the average type conditions.
and all of your research points that the climate on the Earth will increase over time. Is that right?
The warming, it will continue to warm. Not only my research, but the research of tens of thousands of my colleagues around the world. And the fact of the matter is, there's no evidence that to the contrary. So it's not like we're having this roaring debate. You know, this is what I you know, as a scientist, why one of the reasons that motivated me to write this book was that there's so much of these basic questions in the public discourse that we've long dismissed within the scientific community. And I think it's really important to understand the history of where we're coming from, the basic physics of the climate system, and understanding what's going to happen in the future and why we can say that.
So one wonders, though, if the temperature of the Earth will be increasing over time, is that inevitable, or can we do anything now to stop that?
Oh, well, of course we can. We have warming in store for decades to centuries ahead as we try to equilibrate to the levels of greenhouse gases that already exist. That doesn't mean that we can stop further warming. Let me give you an example. Let's put a pot of water on the stove and turn up the elements. Well, the water will continue to warm. It'll continue to warm more and more until it boils, unless we turn the stove, you know, turn that element off. So what we're in a position now, we've got the element turned on, the water's warming. It's going to stay warm for a long time. It's going to continue to warm as we can try to equilibrate to the levels of greenhouse gases. But if we turn off that stove, it'll eventually stable out. And that's what the scientific community is saying, that the international decision makers have got to start dealing with, is cutting those emissions so that we can stabilize our levels of greenhouse gases, so the Earth system can equilibrate to a climate that's essentially, you know, hospitable for in large parts of the world.
So what can we do? Should we drive less? Should we eat better?
As individuals, well, I've been asked this many times, and I've thought a lot about it. And in my mind, the single most effective thing an individual can do is, number one, support those decision makers who are making a difference and trying to do the right thing in terms of policy. So we all have votes. We all have the ability to convince others to vote in a certain direction. To me, that is the first and most important thing the individual can do, is support the leaders who are trying to make a difference. You know, in British Columbia, we have a province, a government that's really trying to move forward on deal with climate. In California, they do too, parts of Europe. Federally, we're still looking to see what the policies are. It's looking like our present administration still is lacking policy, and maybe some other oppositions are going to build some policy. Support those who are actually making a difference. Number two is, you know, we use our pocketbook. I mean, we have a pocketbook to facilitate change, and we can buy products or use products that have less of a footprint. And you can bet the marketplace will change if we start to assist it by changing, by making choices that move us in the right direction. So in my mind, your spending patterns and your support of individuals are the two single biggest things people could do.
Thomas Friedman from the New York Times has a new book out on the same subject, and he was on IMIS on Monday, saying that the argument really that he had was that we should change our leaders and not just light bulbs.
I agree with him wholeheartedly. Change our leaders, you don't have to change for the sake of change. Again, I think in British Columbia, let's support the vision that's being there. I mean, I don't mind which party's running it, but I do mind when I see political parties playing games, trying to just tip the balance and say things to confuse the public with no other reason than just to try to score political votes. So change is good when it's warranted, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the case.
We're now in the midst of a federal election campaign. Do you think that the issue of climate change, the environment, issues of the environment will play a part in this campaign, a large part, do you think?
I don't know where this campaign is heading. I mean, it depends on, to be frank, it depends on how many natural disasters I think there's going to happen in the next 3 weeks. That seems to be the way public of late are swinging towards dealing with putting it on the radar screens. I'm not sure. Let's see where the latest hurricane lands. I mean, it could be, it could be not. If it is, I frankly hope it is. I think it's such an important issue that it should be right up front and center. And if that is the case, then let's have a proper discourse. And let's have one that recognizes that dealing with global warming is not about dealing with whether you're conservative, liberal, or NDP, or green. It's about doing the right thing for the environment, because for heaven's sake, we've only got one planet. We can't, like, move to another one and, start again. That's not an option. Let's deal with what we got and fix it.
You mentioned the direction of the government in British Columbia. Where else in Canada do you see hopeful examples?
Well, Quebec is another example. I think we, Quebec government's been taking movements. Manitoba has some moving down the direction. We're starting to see more and more of these provinces joining the Western Climate Initiative. Ontario looks like it's heading that direction too. So there is, you know, there's just a few. I mean, Alberta needs to get with the program. You know, the federal conservatives need to get with the program. Hopefully, you know, they will, and we'll move forward.
How would you assess the role that the media has played in covering this story, in reporting it over the years?
That's a great question. It's really changed, and I spent a whole chapter on that in the book, because I start off by talking about what used to be the case. This artificial sense of balance was put forward to the public. That is, you know, they'd go and find one scientist who said that global warming is real, and then they go and search around and find another who said it wasn't, and report both opinions to try to create this sense of balance. And of course, you know, science is not about opinions. It's about you know, experiments, hypothesis testing, proving, refining experiments. For example, if I drop a ball, I'm not going to get one scientist who says the ball is going to go up and look for another who says it's going to go down. We know it's going to go down. But that's changed with time, and that artificial sense of balance has actually moved away. And now I would say that the reporting is actually quite good. And as journalists have become more educated with the issues, as scientists have become more effective at communicating the issues, and as the public has become more demanding of accurate journalism in this particular area.
And how about other things like Live Earth? Do you think those have helped shape the public's consciousness?
I don't know. I mean, again, I start the book off, actually. The very first bit of the book is about Live Earth.
Right.
And what I find there is that I found that, you know, I think it's public awareness, but I don't know that everybody involved actually understands. You know, it's great to have public awareness, but I point out in the book that the first thing that I see in the Live Earth is a guy with a Stop, Say No to Nuclear Power on his T-shirt singing in front of a big audience in Sydney, and I'm thinking, well, you know, yeah, this doesn't make much sense. You know, you've got Say No to Nuclear Power, you're dismissing up front a major solution in a portfolio of solutions that needs to be discussed. And so, you know, I don't think people quite understand necessarily how big the change is required. But I think it's a good thing in trying to move people in the right direction.
How did this book come about?
Yeah, it came about, I mean, I've been giving I've given quite a number of lectures to various diverse groups on the issue of climate science. I've been engaged quite commonly with media people asking questions about science, and I have enormous respect for the media. And I got frustrated with some of the attempts by special interests to communicate disinformation out there. So I thought, well, what I'll do is try to put together my knowledge of the climate system and global warming science and some of the Canadian politics and give something to Canada from a Canadian perspective. There's a lot out there done by Americans or Europeans, but there really is nothing with a real Canadian flavor. And I'm a Canadian. I was born here. I've lived here most of my life. And so I wanted to do something from a Canadian perspective.
And do you find that you have a sense of how the Canadian people feel about this subject?
It's different across the country. I think the young generation, they're looking for change, and this to me is where we're going to see a major impact, is if the younger generation, the 20s, the below 30, get out and vote, they can make a difference, because this issue is going to be fundamentally important in their lifetime. And we're relying on a bunch of gray hairs and older people to actually make the decisions today on what's going to affect that generation. So I see the change, the willingness for change, but it's a little generational. The younger people, what I've seen is a much more willingness to deal with something. The older people are more stuck in their old ways. Not everybody. So I'm hoping that we'll see a push on from young voters to get out there and make a difference.
I haven't read any of the reports, Professor Weaver, any of the panel's reports, I should say, but one suspects that it's probably different in tone than this book, which, as I said off the top, was quite accessible. Was it a challenge for you as an academic to be accessible, to be more general, perhaps?
Well, you're right that the IPCC reports are aimed at a scientific audience, but I typically try to, it was a challenge, yes, but I do a lot of things with schools in my area. We have a lot of school kids come and we do demonstrations. We go into classes. I've given a lot of talks to high school. So I mean, it's all about knowing who your audience is and trying to tailor to your audience. And so while it was challenging, it was very rewarding. And so I'm hoping it comes across well.
Are you finding this book tour fun?
This is my first day, so I've never done anything like this before. So it's all new to me, and so far it's very fun. Yeah.
You referred in the beginning of the book to appearing on a radio show.
Yeah.
May I ask which one that was?
I will never say. You'll have to guess. But in fact, I just got off another radio show. I was just did a show here in Victoria, and the fellow here, in Vancouver, and the fellow here guessed right away. So the evidence is there. It's just a matter of trying to figure it out. I think naming the show was not necessary, because I think the image I was trying to portray was important, but the actual show was not. So I don't know that that's information that's needed.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Professor Weaver, and continued good luck with this book.
Thank you very much, and I very much appreciate the interview.
The book is called Keeping Our Cool Canada in a Warming World, $34 from Viking. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.